Well, I've now written a number of books and articles on globalization, and this is now the, in a way, I think a distillation of last 5 years' effort to understand the issues and to provide some practical proposals for correcting the deficiencies of globalization. My previous efforts were a little bit short on prescription, so I tried to make it up in this one. I can't possibly summarize the book in 10 minutes because it's actually very concise, not a long book, but I've tried to be as concise as I can be in the book. So all I can do, I think, is just to lay out the field. First of all, I have a very rather narrow definition of globalization because I associate it with the globalization of financial markets. And that's something really happened in the last 20 years or so. It's not the first time it happened. It had similar global financial markets in the 19th century. Of course, that period of globalization came to an end, which means that the process is not irreversible. Now, what makes globalization of financial markets so important is that it allows capital to move around freely, and that means that it can escape regulation and taxation. So we now have global markets, but the political system remains firmly based on the sovereignty of states and the ability of states to tax and regulate capital has been weakened by the ability of capital to move around, and that has created a lopsided development. Markets are very good at creating wealth, private wealth. But they are not designed to take care of social needs. And so there's a deficiency in taking care of social needs on a global scale. And our international institutions are better developed, those which deal with trade and financial markets. I call them IFTIs, the international financial and trade institutions, than other institutions that are, for instance, concerned with the preservation of peace or the provision of public goods. So I review the various institutions, I evaluate them, I suggest how they should be changed, and I point out the missing element and the lopsidedness of the current development. I call the current form of global capitalism as a distorted form of a global open society. I very much believe in the idea of an open society, and I define open society as an imperfect society that's capable of or holds itself open to improvement. And I think the improvement we need to introduce into our potential global open society is to have a better balance between markets and the fulfillment of social needs. And I propose some mechanism that we can go into later as to how to fill that need. So I think that might be enough to start off the discussion. I'm sure you pick out some points that you find of interest, and then maybe open it up to the I mean, I don't want to give a summary of the book because then people won't buy it, right?
Okay, I'll hand over now to Clive Crook.
Well, I'm going to presume to say something about what is in George's new book and something about Robert's views, which I know Robert very well. We've discussed these matters. And if I make mistakes about what I think they say, I'm sure they'll correct me. I wanted to start by saying that I think all three of us agree on some important propositions about globalization, though I should say that I'm defining that term much more broadly than George just did. When I talk about globalization in these remarks, I don't just mean integrated capital markets. In fact, I mean that least of all. I'm more interested in integration in goods markets and integration through flows of knowledge. And at the broadest level of generality, international economic interaction. So in my mind, it's not just capital flows. We'll see how much that matters in a minute. The things I think we agree on are the following propositions. You need growth to attack global poverty. Trade is good for growth. And the poorest countries in the world are the ones which globalization has passed by. Now, in an audience with anti-globalists, if I can use that label, I'm not sure how many there are in this audience, but an anti-globalist, I think, would disagree with all of those propositions, quite possibly. But just for the sake of clarity, these are things I think we three agree on. We all think that globalization is a good thing and a necessary thing because of the priority we attach to attacking poverty in the third world.
Would you like me to disagree with you on the subject on which we agree?
I think we can make faster progress if I just get through and finish and then turn it back to you. I think we also agree that globalization challenges governments to change their policies, to adapt their policies and their institutions in order to take full advantage of economic integration and in particular to help people who suffer, as some undoubtedly do, from globalization. Help those people to cope with rapid economic change. So we agree, I think, on that. What do we disagree about? Well, a great many, what I would call second-order issues over how precisely policies should be changed to accommodate and channel globalization to best effect. And one example of this, which I think we'll probably be discussing in more detail, is George's proposal for a new SDR initiative. As a matter of fact, I don't think that's such a good idea. I think more aid is a good idea. And one of the things this SDR proposal is more aid. But it strikes me as not a good way of delivering more aid. But let me say, I think the issues like this are second-order issues. How do you change policy exactly to get the most out of globalization? So far as George and I are concerned, I think we disagree on one first-order issue. And this is the one thing I want to emphasize in these remarks. And George, I'm very glad, mentioned this point in his remarks. George claims, and it is this is claimed by many, that globalization is hollowing out democratic politics, that power is moving from elected politicians to multinational corporations and to the private sector in general. And I want to read a very brief quotation from the book on this. Under the influence of globalization, the character of our economic and social arrangements has undergone a radical transformation. The ability of capital to go elsewhere undermines the ability of the state to exercise control over the economy. The globalization of financial markets has, get this, the globalization of financial markets has rendered the welfare state that came into existence after World War II obsolete because the people who require a social safety net cannot leave the country, but the capital the welfare state used to tax can. And this is the problem, the main problem, I think, in George's mind, and the remedy he proposes in various ways is to build up institutions of international governance, and he has several specific proposals on that. Now, I want to emphasize two things. First of all, the premise of this position, in my view, is plain wrong. Hollowing out is simply not happening. The easiest way to see this is to look at taxes. Are democracies capable, still capable, in a globalizing world, of taxing their citizens in order to pay for needed public services and to finance redistribution? The answer is a resounding yes. Many of the most open economies in the world, in Scandinavia, have tax rates as a proportion of GDP substantially in excess of 50%. If you look at countries elsewhere in the world, Britain, America, European Union, the OECD as a group, and ask, have taxes risen or fallen as a share of GDP over the past 10 years when we've been in the middle of this, you know, raging storm of globalization? The answer is yes. In Britain, they've gone up from 37.5% to 39%, and Gordon Brown is softening us up for much more in the next budget. In the US, taxes have gone up from 29% of GDP to 31.6%. In the EU, from 42.3% to 44.5%. And in the OECD as a whole, from 34.9% to 36.8%. So I ask you, where is this hollowing out? Now, it may be that developing international governance, which George wants to do, would be desirable anyway. George is claiming that you have to do it because the state is disappearing. I say that's wrong. But it might be that developing international institutions is a good thing in its own right, even though the national state remains strong. Well, I have two problems with the idea of further developing international institutions in the way I think George would like. The first is accountability. Bodies like the IMF, the World Bank, and the ITO are very remote from citizens. They are already intensely controversial and unpopular for that very reason. If they or bodies like them are given more powers, this problem is only going to get worse. I've heard no plausible solution to this accountability problem, and I found nothing in George's book on it. The second problem is even more fundamental. It seems to me that at this global level, we have a problem of the missing polity. Democracies are about brokering compromises among individuals and among interest groups. They do that within a political community. They call for sacrifices for the collective good. This requires, in my view, some commonality of goals and values, and it requires an ongoing political dialogue. Is this what we see on the global level? For the moment, desirable as it might be in principle, the idea seems to me completely utopian. There are few, if any, universal values. There is precious little sense of shared destiny, and no prospect, so far as I can see, of political dialogue at levels beneath the elite. And wishing it otherwise doesn't change this. So to conclude, the implication of this is that democratically authorized cooperation among nations is going to have to be based on mutual advantage, case by case, on ad hoc collaboration, and above all, it must always be voluntary until this missing polity and the appropriate democratic institutions appear. It cannot be, international cooperation cannot be, or anyway should not be, comprehensively institutionalized and mandatory in the way I think George would like to move. We've already gone too far down that path, in my view. The IMF is one example of going too far down that path. This is the one issue on which I agree with anti-globalists. And I think the European Union is another. But to go further down this path, as I think George wants to, would simply be profoundly undemocratic.
Well, that's given us a lot to debate. I think I'll go straight on to Robert, and then you come back, unless you're dying to come in at this point.
No, it's all right. It's going to be difficult, but because, you know, there are so many issues involved. But, okay, why don't we get the other view first?
Well, I'm going to bring the discussion down to earth with a dull thud, I'm afraid, because I'm going to talk about the pivot of the book. The pivot of the book is a proposal to significantly expand and somewhat change the present arrangement for special drawing rights, or SDRs. I imagine that for many of you, as for me, your eyes glaze over when you hear the term SDRs. But in fact, this idea for increasing international aid through the device of increasing, expanding, and changing the governance of SDRs, special drawing rights, in the IMF, is, I think, the key proposal of your book. It's certainly the one that you and others have given most prominence to. And I was actually specifically asked by the chairwoman to address this proposal, which is why I'm not
going to... That's no excuse.
I'm not going to take you up on...
You should take him up too, because we want to get to the
right, debate. Right, but not right now. So let me just say, first of all, about this SDR proposal. I think it's in many ways a good idea. That is, it's good particularly because it focuses attention onto public attention onto apparently quite arcane monetary issues, which in fact have a huge impact on the performance of the world economy, but are normally not given much public attention at all. And I think that you're quite right that various kinds of changes in the world monetary system could produce significant improvements in the performance of the world economy. And so that's point number one. Point number two is that the fact that your proposal is really quite modest in terms of the amount of money that it would involve, especially the rich countries, in committing to this increased aid, the fact that it's quite modest means that it's also more doable than if you were launching a great big increase. And I think that the third interesting element about it is the link that you make between these apparently quite arcane monetary things to do with SDRs on the one hand, and the supply of global public goods on the other. I certainly need no convincing that the world could do with a substantially more bigger and more reliable supply of public goods. And your idea about how this might be accomplished is I think certainly one which is worth debating, especially when you consider that the main way of providing many public goods in this sort of economic realm at the moment is through organizations like the World Bank, which are heavily dominated by the representatives of wealthy states and their agenda of what are the important global public goods to be supplied may not correspond with the agenda of people living in developing countries as to what are the important global public goods. And your proposal for linking SDRs with increased supply of global public goods at least goes some way in the direction of changing this present system, which, as I said, is heavily weighted towards the preferences of the rich countries. But, and I'll come back to what the essence of your scheme is in a minute, but let me just say finally that we shouldn't kid ourselves that this proposal, even if it is implemented, big question mark, even if it were to be implemented, even if the US Congress would agree to this, which almost certainly wouldn't, we shouldn't kid ourselves that it will make a big difference. It really is small potatoes, and it sort of sits on the edge of the really big issues about the structural features that are impeding the performance of the world economy, especially impeding the catch-up of developing countries. And my worry is simply that by not talking about these big issues that your proposal is sitting on the edge of, the attention given to your proposal may actually occlude from view, obscure from view, what these really big issues are. But so let me just summarize what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, to be the essence of your proposal. Special drawing rights, SDRs, are a form of special purpose money that the IMF can create by crediting the accounts of its member states with an amount of SDRs at an exchange rate set by a basket of currencies. The allocation of these SDRs, the special form of money, very limited purpose money, goes strictly according to countries' quotas. That means that any allocation of SDRs, at least according to anything like the present rules, goes mainly to the rich countries, to the US, to Britain, to Germany, and so on, to Japan. And that obviously is a problem. The innovation in your proposal is to say, okay, we do an allocation of SDRs. Most of them go to the rich countries, which can't actually do very much with them to benefit themselves in any direct way. So what we do is we get the rich countries to agree that they will donate their SDRs to a sort of trust fund, a trust fund which can be drawn upon by worthy projects in developing countries, worthy projects in developing countries which have a high spillover effect, that is, which have a high dimension, a high quotient of public goodness about them, such as, let us say, your example, tuberculosis control programs in Africa would have a high, and other infectious disease programs would have a high degree of global public goodness about them. And the arrangement would be this. You would have a sort of board of eminent persons, and that is your phrase, no indication as to whom these eminent persons might be. Perhaps some of them might be sitting at this table. But a board of eminent persons...
One of them at any rate.
who would be governing... what this board would do would be to choose a menu, not actual projects, but choose a menu of worthwhile projects in developing countries. And then the donors, say the United States or Britain or Japan, they would come in and they would select from this menu of projects that had been certified as worthwhile and likely to pay off by this board of eminent people. These donors would come in and select which projects they wanted their SDRs to be used for. And at the point where their SDRs came to be used, then they would have to pay in real money. That is, if a certain project used SD for tuberculosis control in Africa had a budget of SDRs worth $100 million, and the US had chosen that program to support, then the US would pay $100 million in support of the project. So this would be a device for administering an increase in aid, which would not be going through simple bilateral channels, though in the end I think it is largely bilateral, but not simple bilateral channels, but it would be going through the screen of the board of the eminent people. And so that would be the way that it would work. And then, of course, also, in addition to that, the poor countries that would get some SDRs, because they also pay some quota, they could use their SDRs for repaying their debt to the IMF or repaying their debt to the Paris Club, or for if they went into crisis and they needed a quick infusion of IMF money, they could present these SDRs to the IMF and request dollars in exchange. So there are some specific benefits to developing countries from an increase in SDRs. Well, let me come to some problems, some obvious problems with this proposal that I think that you're not clear about. One of them is, what is in this for the US government? Because the US, there has been a proposal before the Congress for several years to increase SDRs without your particular mechanism, but just to increase SDRs. And the US Congress is saying no, because the US Congress doesn't like SDRs. The Congress has always distrusted the IMF. And the question is, why would the Congress trust a board of eminent persons, presumably these are not all Americans, any more than the Congress trusts the IMF? There doesn't seem to be much in it for the US. And perhaps your answer to that point is, well, we have mass campaigns, and like Jubilee 2000, and the Congress will listen to mass campaigns, so if civil society is mobilized, we have a chance of getting this through the US Congress. Your proposal is actually surprisingly short on what would be in this for the developing countries themselves. I just summarized what I think would be in it, but it does seem to me that to sustain a big world public campaign in favor of essentially more aid through this channel, you need to spell out more the answer to the question, what would be in this for the developing countries apart from the benefits of these greater public goods, global public goods programs. And then there's this question of the governance, the question of this board of eminent persons. You describe it just in those terms and then say very little more about how exactly they might be selected. And of course, the question of how such a board would be selected is closely related to what sorts of things this board would consider to be high priorities for global public goods. You mentioned things like infectious diseases, judicial reform. You don't mention environment. I don't think you mentioned financial stability. But these are certainly items that the World Bank identifies as important global public goods. So the point is that we don't have good criteria for scaling the priority of global public goods. And just at this point, in parenthesis, let me mention one of my favorite global public goods, which is more social science generation of knowledge in developing countries themselves. I think it is quite astonishing the degree of disparity in the generation of social science knowledge in the 15% of the world's population living in OECD countries and the 85% of the world's population living in developing countries. And you can see this, just how huge this disparity is, reflecting the fact that developing countries have not yet, after 50 years of development, developed a capacity to produce social science knowledge, which they can then use to guide their futures. They've not done this. You can see this, how big the disparity is, by taking the authors of papers given to the annual World Bank Conference on Development Economics, the ABCDE conferences, from 1995 to 2000, there were 76 authors of papers given to these World Bank conferences. Of those 76 authors, 75% were from the US, another 20% from Britain and Europe, and exactly 5% of authors came from developing countries, even though every one of these papers was about developing countries. That disparity should be ringing very loud alarm bells, and I would myself propose that this area should be a high priority for the supply of global public goods. Just let me mention one other set of problems. And that is to do with what you say about multilateral institutions. You are very keen, like Clive is very keen, on more aid. More aid you emphasize in particular in the form of grants rather than loans, because loans carry debt, and that then can become a problem. I am sympathetic with that up to a point, but I want to just float, and this is my final point, a much more radical idea. And the radical idea is for a grand accord. On the one hand, developing countries would renounce aid and concessional finance, all except the poorest developing countries. I'm talking of the more middle-income ones. They would renounce aid and concessional finance. What that means is that they would give up the positive freedoms, that is, the freedom to do things, the modest increment in positive freedoms that this aid and concessional finance gives them. They would give that up. In return, they would get back in this grand accord a big expansion of negative freedoms. By negative freedoms, I mean freedom from. And by freedom from, I'm meaning freedom from protection, significant protection against their exports in agriculture and textiles and many other things in the wealthy countries. The wealthy countries would agree to reduce this protection against developing country exports. Wealthy countries would agree to give up this current push for a really tough intellectual property regime. They would give that up in return for not giving aid. And they would agree to give up the idea of trying to tie environmental and labor standards into trade agreements. which actually become another form of trade barrier facing developing countries. That would be the nature of the Grand Accord. Developing countries, at least these middle ones, would have expanded negative freedoms, freedoms from the discrimination that they currently suffer in the world economy. Okay, I'm not being entirely serious. I know that such an accord is not going to happen, and if it's not going to happen, then I have, yes, some considerable sympathy with the need for new aid, but you have to question how this new aid is to be delivered, because with our present arrangements, it just doesn't seem to be working very well, and maybe your scheme, especially if it was expanded, might be something which would improve the situation. Notice my hesitation at the end, might be.
Well, thanks. I'm going to let George Soros now reply, if he wishes to.
Definitely. I think it might be good to maybe stick to the SDR proposal, because it's a concrete proposal and it's sort of quite hot right now. And then maybe if we have time, we can come back or to the larger issues. You are absolutely right in emphasizing that this is really just at the margin of the big issues. And it's really peanuts. In the first instance, we are talking about an issue of $27 billion, of which $18 billion would go to the rich countries that would donate them. Gordon Brown made an eloquent plea for $50 billion a year to meet the Millennium Targets. And we now have a conference on financing for development in Monterey coming up in 2 weeks' time. And I think there will be no financing for development offered at that conference. So the main reason I came up with this proposal is that it's a concrete proposal, because there is an issue already approved by the IMF and by 72% of the membership. All it needs is the US Congress to approve it. It puts it over the limit of 85%, and it can be implemented immediately. So that is, I would say, the reason why I focused on it. In the rest of my book, I dealt with a lot of larger issues about financial stability, the need for bankruptcy, procedures that will then reveal the next weakness in the system that will also need to be corrected. I think that is something that may become pressing in 2003. The reason I've been focusing on it, and I really gave it a lot of time lately, because I think it is doable, it's doable now, and it's particularly become kind of very appropriate after September 11, and that there is, in fact, bilateral, bipartisan support for this, and either the U.S. administration is going to actually propose it, which I would give a very high probability of, let's say, 1 in 3, which is very high. In other words, not likely to happen, but it's closer to happening than at any previous time. Or in fact, there will be a clamor that something needs to be done. The drawback of the proposal is that it's complicated. As Bono said to me, it doesn't rhyme. SDR doesn't rhyme.
Well, surely he can fix that.
Right? Well, that's what I said to him, actually. If this isn't what we agree on, then what is that we are going to agree on? In other words, the U.S. administration takes a position that that foreign aid doesn't work. And you have to study why it doesn't work, and you have to prove that it's going to work, and then we'll consider it. I say here is a scheme that has that promises to work, that it's something different, that overcomes many of the weaknesses, deficiencies of the present way of giving aid, because aid now, foreign aid, mainly doesn't work because it's designed to meet the needs of the donors rather than the needs of the recipients. Having this jury of eminent persons would ensure that the needs of the recipients, in other words, the efficiency of the program, would get due consideration. Now, nobody wants to delegate authority to an unaccountable group of experts. That's very unattractive. But nobody is going to is asked to delegate because the donor countries retain the right to allocate their donations. So there is the same accountability as there is in normal bilateral aid, but you have this additional process of selecting and constructing the programs so that they hang together, and that the bilateral aid is actually coordinated, because there isn't proper coordination at the present time. It also, most of the aid today is intergovernmental and goes bilateral. The World Bank, which I probably hold in higher esteem than you do, is confined by its constitution that it has to deal with governments. And because of that, the fact that it's intergovernmental really makes a lot of its activities counterproductive. Very often, the loans go to sustain repressive or corrupt governments. But according to the charter of the World Bank, it has no choice but to go through that route. And let's face it, the developed countries that sit on the board have been known to take national interests into account also, but let's say they won't want to encourage industries that would compete with their industries and so on. So this channel, which would be additional, I wouldn't want to interfere with the existing forms of aid. This would be additional, and it would be tested first in the first instance with this $18 billion, dedicated to public health, education, and legal reforms. And for that, those are areas where you can, in fact, find eminent persons who know the field and who would be devoted to making it work. So that is why I'm laying such emphasis on it at the present time. One other thing I should mention is that there's really a big disparity between how foreign aid is viewed in Europe and in America. In America, it's a dirty word. And the European countries give more than three times more than the United States to aid. The United States, if you ask the people, how much do you think we spend on foreign aid? They say anywhere between 1% and 8%. Actually, the United States is spending 0.1% on foreign aid. This would get a more equitable distribution of the burden, and it would get the U.S. by showing that it works better, then opens up the way for enlargement, at which time it could be used also for reforming the current ways of giving. So I think that is my reasoning for that. And maybe, I don't know if you maybe...
Shall we take a few questions and then you'll have a chance to come back? And maybe some people want to come back at some of the people on the floor. So who would like to ask a question? Is there a couple of roving mics? Let me have a look. There's one over here.
Hello?
Could you say your name? And
my name's Keith Nielsen. My question isn't directly connected to the system that George Soros is putting forward, but it is related. And I'd like to know what the opinion of the panel is on it, which is that Thomas Jefferson put forward the principle that the fruit of the earth belongs to the living. He proposed that as a self-evident truth, along with the other self-evident truths of the American Declaration. that was a related form of that idea was put forward by Saint-Simon, who was an advisor to Napoleon. And essentially, it boils down to the notion that inheritance tax, that the burden of taxation should, as far as possible, fall upon inheritance tax. I'd just like to know what the response of the panel is to that question.
I won't ask them to answer that. I'll take a few more if there are people. Yes, the lady here.
That for me, because I don't know.
He said he thought the burden of taxation should be inheritance.
Can you speak up? The
people shouldn't inherit.
That's not working.
Okay.
I'd like to know what proposals you put forward for ensuring stability in the financial system.
And then there's a lady over there. By the way, it doesn't matter, but it's nice if you say your name and where you're from.
I am Benjamin von Breed. I'm one of the economists, panel co-founders. And I would like to ask about one topic we haven't really touched upon, terrorism and poverty, and the link that is increasingly made between poverty and terrorism. And isn't it sort of not exactly dangerous but rather simplistic to link the two and say, well, we now of course have to give more because otherwise we would foster more terrorists in poor countries?
Poverty and terrorism. Do we have to give to foster more terrorists, to prevent terrorists?
Yeah, the gentleman over there.
Right. As far as proposal to increase aid and so forth, it's all a good thing. But you have to wonder if reviving SDR is actually the right avenue to it. Because if you think about it, SDR, the reason it failed is because it fails to become international reserves currency to replace the U.S. dollar, the greenback. Okay, so I think if anything, that is one of the reasons why there's no, let's say, distributed power in terms of capital market control, because at the end of the day, it's always going back to the greenback. I mean, one of the panelists even mentioned that if a country has an extra SDR granted to them, they can redeem that for dollar. So at the end of the day, it's the dollar that backs the SDR, rather than SDR that forms the central part of the integral part of the international monetary framework. Okay, but in terms of increasing aid, I also think that it's more like a World Bank game rather than something that's the IMF arena. You know, I'm not a big fan of World Bank by any means, but it seems that, you know, there's framework existing already as far as channel for moving assistance. And the problem is not that it isn't there. The problem is, if you look back to the UN figures, the United States is behind paying its dues. Okay, so it's a matter of getting the first world economies to stump up its obligations. And also another problem with SDR, if you're talking about increasing size for the developing countries, for the developed country, because they can afford to help more, they can increase the SDR allocation and so forth. The problem with that is IMF actually uses SDR as a basis for allocating voting rights. So what's happening is country like Palau, for example, that has a GDP maybe 0.4% of the U.S. actually gets that much vote relative to the U.S. So it becomes a political basis as well. So if the U.S. is already is increasing the SDR allocation, presumably because that helps with the funding of all the worthwhile projects, it's also increasing the lopsidedness in the representation in the IMF. And you know that the disparity in GDP on the world scale measures on exponential scale. So if anything, if you want to do anything, you have to correct the mechanism for voter representation in the IMF.
Okay, thank you. If anyone else wants to ask a question, I won't ask you to repeat it. Make it a question, not a speech. But I will now let our panel respond to these, and if we have time for one more round after that, we'll do our best. Would you like to begin?
Okay. I'll try. On the SDRs, I mean, I'm combining two things. You see, one is the SDR allocation itself, which benefits the developing countries, but is of no particular use to the developed countries that have access to the financial markets. Now, as far as the donation is concerned, it's not a free source of money. Once you donate it, you have to pay for it. So it has to go through the same budget process as any other donation would. So there is no free lunch. That's very important to recognize. It's not a sleight of hand to create donations that doesn't cost. You have to pay for it if you donate. The developing countries that get the allocations, they actually get something as close to a free lunch as is possible, because they add it to their reserves. When they receive it, they have to pay interest on it. When they hold it, they get interest on it. So it doesn't cost them anything, but it increases their monetary reserves. And there are a number of arguments to be made why this is necessary. Most obvious one is that international trade is growing at twice the rate of GDP, and the reserves, minimum reserves that you need, are related to your import requirements. You need at least 3 months' imports. So you provide the extra reserves that enable those countries to grow. I could go on, but it would get too technical. The main thing is that you really, the developing countries, when they get the SDRs, they do get a lunch that is free as long as you don't eat it. In other words, if you hold it in reserves, you've got extra reserves, and that is a net benefit. The other part of it is merely to get a discipline into the and the burden sharing for the donations. Now, inheritance tax, I happen to agree with you, but that's one thing that is really rendered particularly difficult by the globalization of financial markets, because rich people can take their estate somewhere else, and themselves even. I mean, I know a number of tax refugees. In fact, they used to be shareholders of my fund. The relationship between poverty and terrorism is not as simple as that. I think, there are always terrorists or people of extreme views who are willing to do anything to advance those views, and reducing poverty won't eliminate terrorism. But how, I mean, terrorists are basically doing what they're doing in order to polarize society, to have influence on society. And by removing the grievances, you remove the support that terrorists can enjoy. And you know how much support Bin Laden has in many Islamic countries. So reducing reducing poverty and addressing injustices, which are not entirely poverty, because they are cultural and so on, would reduce the support on which they can draw. And the only way you really can eliminate terrorism or deal with it is if people inform on them, if people don't want them to succeed, then in fact they disappear, as they did in Italy and Germany and so on. So that is the connection there. And then I was asked about the other measures of stability, and that actually really we have to come back to your remarks. Because I think that there is an inherent disparity or in the system as it currently functions. It favors the countries at the center, particularly the United States, to the disadvantage of the countries at the periphery. And the reason for that is that, contrary to some people that write in The Economist, financial markets do not tend towards equilibrium. They are inherently unstable. And in order to avoid them from breaking down, you need to direct them, to manage them. And the management is in the hands of the countries at the center. And that gives them, it's not the only advantage they have, but that gives them a great advantage. And the countries at the periphery, let's say, were to some extent, in a very inefficient way, compensated by the willingness of the IMF to bail them out if they got into difficulties. It was very inefficient because the countries suffered. The bailing out was really the bailing out of the banks and the lenders, and the loans were enabling the debtor countries to meet their obligations to prevent the financial system from collapsing. So it was recognized that this involves a moral hazard, and it was determined that we mustn't go on doing this. And in fact, in the last crisis, the moral hazard was effectively cured, because a number of Russia, for instance, defaulted, and so it has been brought the real risks of investing in the emerging markets. Market economies has now been recognized by the market. And because of that, this I think will avoid a repeat of the last crisis. But it has the seeds of the next crisis, which is the inadequate flow and very high risk premium attached to investing in the developing countries. And this is already, it was a hypothetical case when I originally put it. It's certainly reflected in the figures since 1997. It's meant to be a temporary phenomenon. I think it's a structural change due to the change in the way the IMF doesn't bail out. The IMF now wants to bail in instead of bailing out. And it talks about burden sharing, but investors are not philanthropic institutions, and if they have to share a burden, they charge for it. And that's what's reflected in the inadequate flow of capital. And of course, we now have Argentina, and the default of Argentina has really hurt the foreign direct investments. So it may have a negative effect on the flow of direct investments, which was considered to be the most stable and desirable form of capital flows. So to it is now recognized that you need to have some bankruptcy procedures, and I support that. But that will have an interesting effect, because actually sovereign loans have no collateral. You know, you don't have real estate or anything securing the loan. The only collateral you have is the pain associated with default. And Argentina is a very good demonstration of that pain, because it's really a chaotic breakdown. So if you now have an orderly bankruptcy, you then reduce the pain, you also reduce the value of the collateral, and again, that makes the bonds more risky and more expensive. So my argument is that the next step is that you will have to provide some incentives for countries that follow sound policies, credit enhancements or credit guarantees, to offset the additional risks that the new situation has created. And I have four specific proposals of credit enhancements. So that is my agenda for 2003, not for 2002.
Clive. First of all, let me thank George for pointing out to us that financial markets are unstable. As soon as I get back to the office, I'll let our finance writers know, and we'll try and do better on this in the future. I feel a bit left out in this discussion, so let me come back to this SDR point, which I rather skated over. I can't oppose this plan with much conviction, because, as I did say, I agree that more aid, intelligently spent, is a good thing. And I understand that that is exactly what you're trying to do. You know, that is the whole idea of this plan, is to deliver more aid, a somewhat rather modest amount of more aid, as Robert said, and get it spent more intelligently. But I want to ask, you know, why do it this way? I can think of one...
Do it another way, I don't care.
Well, this is the issue, right? This is the issue we've been discussing. I can think of one rationale for this incredibly complicated proposal, which is that it's a way to sneak this idea of more aid past voters in America. It may be that you take the view that voters in America will never actually agree to an explicit increase in American aid, and this is a way to sneak it past them. I mean, if you were willing to make that case, I think you might even be able to bring me on board, but you wouldn't be able to defend this as, you know, an exemplary democratic method if the idea was to con people. And if it isn't to con reluctant American voters, then there are dangers in this method. And here I'm even going to try and make a connection between this SDR proposal and the point I was trying to make in my earlier remarks about, you know, the dangers of excessively ambitious multilateralism. The danger in this SDR plan is that we will have endless discussion of ways of delivering this modest increase in aid, and then no actual delivery. Multilateral fora have a very impressive history of displacing concern about the developing countries in just this way. You pointed out, George, that almost all IMF members have voted for an increased allocation of SDRs. This is not exactly what you're proposing, but a similar thing has been on the table for years, and America's always vetoed it. I would submit that an awful lot of the countries that have ratified the SDR allocation have done so in the certain conviction that America will veto it. And if they had any plausible expectation that America might not, they would have thought more carefully about how to do it. This happens again and again. In my view, the Kyoto Treaty on Global Warming is another example. Europe is dead keen on this mainly because they know America will never do it, and that gives them an excuse for not doing it themselves. The case I was trying to make was for enlightened unilateralism, let's call it that. If we're in favor of more aid for developing countries, then let's all, country by country, start giving them more aid. Britain doesn't need to wait for America to vote for this SDR plan to give more aid. Let's just get on with it and do it. And this, the danger I see in this proposal is that it may actually, in the politics of the thing, block actual delivery by allowing people to pretend they're doing something when they aren't.
Well, certainly nothing is going to stop Britain from, and Britain has actually committed to gradually increase. And Britain in this respect is out in front. So I don't think that anything you have said really detracts from the proposal, and there's no conning of the American public, because it has to go through the budget proposal, and I think that the American public is ready for it. I think there's some element of conning of the Europeans because they would now have to live up to it. But I think that it would be such a welcome relief to see the United States actually participating in a multilateral action that the Europeans would be very pleased with it. Anyhow.
Robert.
Well, I just wanted to say one word about the financial stability point. I said at the beginning that my worry about this proposal is that it actually diverts attention from some of the really big issues. And the big issue I just want to put on the table in the space of 2 minutes is what seems to me the engine at the heart of the world economy, which is generating chronic financial instability and slow growth, especially slow growth in many, not all, developing countries. It seems to me that the engine is comprised of three components. One of them is the breakdown of the Bretton Woods agreement, where the dollar was tied to some supply-side constraint, so that since the breakdown of Bretton Woods in 71, there's been effectively no supply-side constraint on the ability of the US economy to run very large deficits, provided only that other people want to hold them. And the second component, which makes other people want to hold them, is that economic actors are required to enter into international transactions to buy imports or to borrow loans, not in their own currency, except for the US, but in one of the few hard currencies. They can't make these transactions in their own currencies. And the third element is that all this is now going, post the breakdown of Bretton Woods, is going through private financial institutions, not through national central banks. And this combination of elements is a combination which makes for continuously increasing financial flows relative to real flows, and continuous volatility in things like exchange rates, because exchange rates are being driven not by relative costs of production and relative demand for goods and services, but by essentially speculative guesses as to what future exchange rates will consist of. And you know more about that than anybody else. It seems to me that this is a mechanism that generates a rising propensity to crisis, especially in the so-called emerging market economies. And if we want to move towards a more stable world economy with more equitable growth, then we have to start looking at these basic components of this engine of instability, and that will take us back to look again at Keynes's proposals that he brought to Bretton Woods, because don't forget that the world we're living in is not such a very different world from the world of the 1920s.
Thanks. Do you know that we have 1 minute, and I wonder if George wants to say anything for the last minute?
No, All I can say is that I happen to be a Keynesian because that's the last time that I, you know, I used to be at LSE and learned then. And I haven't learned anything since. So, and the world has come around to me. I think Keynes lives again.
Well, my father, who was a Keynesian, used to say that that's his explanation of cycles. Every other generation is a Keynesian, or every other generation is a monetarist. So thank you very much indeed, and I hope everybody reads the book, and we'll have lots more discussion.